In November 2009, I met with Trish Horgan, the manager of operations and support services at the City of Toronto, and we had an extensive conversation about LGBTQ youth homelessness in Toronto. If we could just start off with, if you could just introduce yourself and sure. tell us a bit about your role here at the City of Toronto.
Okay, I'm Trish Horgan, and I am the manager of operations and support services here in Hostel Services. And basically the unit that I work within, we provide oversight and administration to all the homeless shelters in the City of Toronto that receive funding from the city. So included in that, I guess the primary areas of responsibility would be around ensuring that shelter providers are in compliance with the Toronto Shelter Standards, which is basically our document that lays out our expectations to anyone who gets funding from us. And the other piece that's a huge part of the work is around our quality assurance review process. I have a number of staff who work within my unit. They're called agency review officers. And really their job is to work with shelter providers, you know, to make sure that they're in compliance with this document, and they administer the quality assurance review process and then help agencies who aren't meeting what's in the standards then come to a place where they are eventually meeting everything that's in the standards. The other piece, that's sort of the programmatic piece of it. The other piece that is a big part of the work that is done in my unit is around the funding administration. So the city is actually the consolidated service manager, which means that the province basically flows funding through us and we administer it out to the agencies at a more, I guess, sort of frontline level. So that's a big part of our work as well, is working with providers from a financial perspective.
Okay, yeah, great. And what about in terms of planning services? I know it's different for adults and for youth.
Right.
What is the difference in the process that the city takes in planning services for youth versus adults?
Yeah, I mean, I think that from our perspective, because we are the service system manager, I think that we plan services, or the strategic direction that we set out is really for the entire system.
Okay.
That's not to say that, you know, we recognize that there are sort of unique needs by each of our client groups. So say, for example, we have 57 shelters in the City of Toronto that we fund or directly operate, because we are what we call a mixed service delivery model. We have 9 shelters that are directly operated by the city.
Okay.
And then the remaining 48 shelters are operated by community-based agencies. So when we're doing planning, we plan for the whole system. Each sector, though, we realize is more specific to the unique client group. So we have a men's sector, we have a women's sector, we have a mixed adult sector, the youth sector. We really leave the more frontline sort of operational or programmatic planning to the individual operators.
Okay.
So through documents like our standards, we certainly put out what our expectations are around planning and sort of how it relates to that piece around program planning, specifically say for youth, is that, you know, one of the things in the standards says that when our shelter providers are setting their strategic direction and doing their program planning, they need to be consulting with their client groups, and that's entrenched in our standards, and we go out and review that and monitor that and make sure that that's actually happening. But I think our perspective is that we believe that our shelter providers know the clients best, because they certainly are at that much more frontline level. So say, for example, a youth shelter, Eva's Initiative run 3 youth shelters for us. Our philosophy is that Eva's no youth. Right, they know their clients. They're doing the day-to-day operations, so we expect them to be doing the more frontline strategic planning, program planning, consulting with clients, all of that sort of stuff, and then implementing those programs into their day-to-day operations.
Okay,
but yeah, we focus much more on the broader system, and then wanting to make sure that when those individual providers are rolling out their programs, that it does reflect what's in our standards and what our expectations are.
Okay, what about the like the shelters that are run purely by the city? So not the joint ones, but the ones that are run by the city.
Yeah.
Is the community involved in the planning of those shelters, of those programs?
Well, interesting, because I know certainly when we, a lot of our shelters have or have had in the past, particularly when a new shelter is opening, they have what we call community liaison committees.
Okay.
So, you know, part of a process when a new shelter opens up, it is an expectation that they would, that that shelter provider, as they're going in, would establish a community liaison committee. And that would consist of representation from the city, representation from the shelter provider, as well as community representation. And it's more of, I don't know if it would actually be that the community would actually have input into the programming, but it's certainly about sharing information. It's about dealing with any complaints that might come forward. It's about dealing with issues that come forward, mm-hmm. all of that sort of thing. But again, we expect the providers to be engaged in their local communities.
Mm-hmm.
We actually expect that shelters have what we would consider sort of a good neighbors policy,
mm-hmm.
kind of folded into their complaints policy, so that they are, you know, they're part of a community and they need to be sort of have a presence in the community as well.
Right.
You know, when you talk about community involvement, interesting, because one of the things that we're doing right at the moment, we're going to be embarking on at the beginning of next year, is the rewrite of our Toronto shelter standards.
Oh.
So it works into our quality assurance review process, which is a three-phase process. So the start of it is we have a set of shelter standards, brand new. I'm going back to 2002. It's approved by council. We put it out to shelter providers, tell them that they need to be in adherence with it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go out and review that through our QA process. It's basically a line-by-line assessment to make sure that everybody's meeting the 477 indicators that are in this document. Phase two is a bit more of an in-depth review of certain areas. And then phase three, which we will be, as I mentioned, embarking in, is the rewrite of the standards. And I think this is where the city engages our community providers in initiatives such as this. So what will happen is we will, and what happened when we rewrote this version of the standards in 2002, we'll pull together a steering committee. It's a really large group of people. I mean, you can see if you look at the beginning of the standards, if you actually look at the document, the mm-hmm. amount of people that were involved in the writing of this version of it. And it's quite well represented in terms of everybody from, there's political representation, mm-hmm. the drop-in sector, the health sector, housing sector. We had people from 519, from the meal trans program.
Right.
Shelter providers are represented on it, Toronto Police Services, Toronto Public Health. So this is kind of, because we consider this document to be so integral to the work that's done out there,
yeah.
that's kind of where we get our really broad representation of our community providers. And they actually have input into what will be the rewriting of this document.
Okay.
So we've now had 3 years to work with this particular, no, actually more than that. We probably had about 2002, 2003. So we've probably had about 5 or 6 years that we've worked with this version of the standards, you know, knowing that needs change,
yeah.
the system changes, it needs to be a fluid document. So
yeah.
we'll be moving into that, consulting with, you know, as broad a range of stakeholders as we can to make sure that the new version of the standards is reflective of, you know, the evolution of the system and the needs that are out there now.
Absolutely. And how often do the shelter standards get sort of changed?
It is every third phase of quality assurance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you assume that, you know, this version was approved in 2002, we did our QA review of it in 2004, we've done a phase two review since then. We'll be moving into 2010. So it would have been 8 years.
Okay.
I think ultimately we'd like to tighten that up. This was the first time that we actually associated quality assurance with our shelter standards. So it took us a little bit longer because we had to develop the process. And there was a whole consultation process around that. We had a shelter provider reference group, and they were involved in what helping us shape what quality assurance is. I would hope that as we get to the next cycle of it, that it would actually be a much tighter, and that maybe we would be rewriting the standards every 5 years.
Okay.
Would sort of yeah. be an ultimate kind of goal.
Yeah, for sure. That's mm-hmm. great. I think it's really wonderful that the city has shelter standards.
Ooh.
Of course, that's definitely necessary and needed.
Right.
And I think that, I guess sometimes it's hard to know if everyone's meeting those standards, right?
Absolutely.
And sometimes the city might not even be aware of what's going on in certain shelters.
Absolutely.
So how does the city ensure that these standards are being met?
Well, and I think that the primary way that we do that is through our quality assurance review process. And it's, I mean, as I said, in 2004, we went out to each and every shelter, directly operated or not. It was really a line by line. We went in, we had interviews with staff, we wanted to look at policies, we did a physical inspection to make sure everything that's supposed to be posted is posted. We went through staff training records to make sure that people were actually meeting the standards in terms of staff training. Mm-hmm. It was probably a full day review at each and every site. Then we moved into phase two, so we compiled the results, sent it out to providers and said, you know, you scored whatever it was. And we actually found that overall, when we did this this first round of QA, that the average score for shelter providers across the system was 80%, which is actually quite good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our expectation is 100%,
of course, yeah.
Because we do consider this to be the minimum standards. But 80% for the first time out the door was actually quite good. Then, you know, at the end, everybody would get their results and they had to submit a remediation work plan back to us to say what they were going to do to fully meet the standards that they only partially met or didn't meet. And our agency review officers worked with each shelter provider to make sure that they did the things that they said they were going to do within the allotted timelines. So we then, again, went back out a year later. And reevaluated people who hadn't met those particular standards. And we found that the average score went up by about 10%.
Hmm.
So by and large, I think people are doing quite well in terms of the standards. Our AROs, I think, have a good relationship with the shelter providers, and I think they're primarily the day-to-day contact. So they, I think, have a fairly good handle in terms of, you know, what's going on at each shelter. And that's not to say your point where, you know, certainly because we're administering the system as a whole,
yeah,
there's going to be things that slip through the cracks. One of the things that we rely on heavily is our complaints line. So each shelter is expected to have a complaints and appeals process. The information is expected to be posted for all to be able to see. Residents are should be made aware of the complaint and appeal process when they enter the shelter. It should be part of the whole admission process.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a larger poster that we actually distribute to providers to get them to post. And it basically states that if someone wants to make a complaint directly to us at the City of Toronto, here's our number, 416-392-8741. And we have a dedicated staff person, and her role, she's our client services supervisor. And her role is to hear complaints.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, you know, I think a really valuable way for us to kind of keep a finger on what's going on out there. We take every complaint that comes into our office very seriously.
Right.
We attempt to mediate anything that comes into our office between the provider and the client or the person making the complainant. We track all the complaints.
Mm-hmm.
We do analysis on it. So if we see particular trends at one particular shelter,
mm-hmm.
Say it's in regards to access, then that then gets referred to the agency review officer who has that discussion with the shelter provider around mm-hmm. what's going on. And they may actually go out and do a site visit. We have the right to go out and do unannounced site visits with our providers to find out what's going on.
Right.
But, you know, certainly I would encourage anyone that is experiencing, you know, anything within the system that they feel either that they want to make a complaint to us, that they should do that, because we really do rely on that as a way to determine if people are meeting what's in the standards.
Mm, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to back up a bit before mm-hmm. we were talking about the sort of about community and about services. And so I was just wondering, how do you communicate the services to the community?
From the city's perspective?
Yeah.
We have a partnership and development unit, which is really our, I guess, our media and communications department.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, heavily involved in any of our messaging or documents or information that goes out. We also have a website that includes a lot of information, a lot of links to services. It's got, you know, our standards are there, our quality assurance review process is there. Any of the, we put out what we call hospital service guidelines to our shelter providers, and they're really a clarification of things that are in the standards. So all of those guidelines are listed on our website for people to go in. It's all public information that's out there. So we also report out to City Council, and to we report to Community Development and Recreation Committee, and a lot of those reports are sort of about our systemic planning, that sort of thing. And those are all public documents that are available on the website. In terms of, I guess, communicating services at, you know, a more frontline level, again, that would be, that kind of ties into that whole piece that we expect providers to have that relationship with the community, that they're perhaps holding open houses and inviting the community in, you know, when it's appropriate to come in and get information about their programs. Because I have to tell you, you know, reading through some of your questions and, you know, about changing the system and maybe some of the shortcomings in the system, I think it's really about education completely. And that's why I think it's really important that our providers are actually out there engaged with the community and educating them about the services. Because I do think there is misinformation that's out there about the system, and sort of the only way you can get around that is by, you know, putting it out there and educating people about what the services are.
Yeah, certainly. And who does the city define as their community?
As in our community?
Yeah.
I mean, I think, do you mean from a service provider level? I mean, I think that certainly our own shelter providers, absolutely.
Right.
We have that very direct relationship with them. I think any other community service agency, you know, drop-ins, housing help centers, community service agencies that specialize in, you know, specialized service planning, say, for example, the 519, very definitely we would consider them one of our partners. I think our other divisions within the city are also our partners, Toronto Police Services. Right now with the H1N1, Toronto Public Health, very much our partners right at the moment. So it's a very broad base and pretty inclusive, I think, in terms of who our partners are. And
great.
Certainly shelter clients have to be part of that as well. We have done some direct surveys and service review initiatives with clients directly, where it was the city as the funder coming directly to the client without going through the shelter. And I think it was really well received by clients. I think many of them really appreciated the fact to speak directly to the funder and have our ear. And I think that's one of the things that we perhaps need to do a better job of moving forward, is actually engaging directly with clients at that frontline level, because I think there's incredible information that can come out of that. That, you know, and probably that's one of the things that we will do when we rewrite this document. I think there absolutely has to be a client or resident advisory group. That it will definitely be part of rewriting this document.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense for sure. And what are the city's main sort of priorities in terms of youth homelessness for the next, I would say, maybe like 5 years or so?
Yeah, I think that certainly, you know, just to sort of back it up a little bit, that our strategic plan at the moment is about housing first. We believe that, you know, services should be focused on helping people find and keep housing. And we believe that the best way to end homelessness is actually to provide people with a permanent place to live. You know, we're sort of are wanting to move away from that managing homelessness to actually ending homelessness. And the way you do that is to put a roof over people's head. And to put that roof over their head, you know, even before coming into the shelter system. So things like our Streets to Homes initiative, where people who, you know, traditionally have not used the shelter system, outreach workers are working directly with them to move them from the street into housing and then provide them with support services on an ongoing basis once they're actually in housing. Mm-hmm. So that's really, you know, the way we're looking at things. The Housing Opportunities Plan, which was a document that was approved by council probably last year, mm-hmm. Recently, talks about some of those, that's what the focus actually should be. I think from an operational program level, because we realize that there still needs to be shelters. You're not going to completely get rid of the system. We need to make sure that the services that are being operated in the various shelters support people, you know, meet people's needs and support them towards moving into housing and keeping housing. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, as far as specific to youth, mm-hmm. we don't, at the city level, we don't get to that specific level. But we would expect, as I said, that youth shelter providers are coming mm-hmm. together as a group, which they do. They have, it's called YSIN. It's the Youth Sector Interagency Network. Mm-hmm. It's a group of executive directors and, you know, fairly senior management at each of the youth shelters who get together on a regular basis. And we do have staff from our office that sit in on that committee. And they really... That's sort of where I would say, if coming together, if there was sort of youth systematic planning that was happening, it would happen at that level.
Okay.
Yeah. So we sort of, you know, keep in touch with that. Mm-hmm. But really that sort of, they also, you know, they form a bit of an advocacy group as well. So they may identify needs and then bring those needs and they would bring them forward to the city. Actually.
Okay.
But that's where that youth homelessness planning might actually happen.
Right. All right. And just before, you spoke a bit about education and the importance of education. Mm-hmm. And that's something I agree with completely. I agree that people really, really need to be educated about these issues.
Right.
And I know the city has workshops that they offer as a training mandate for shelters that are funded by the city.
Correct.
And so I'm just wondering, who decides what shelter workers should be learning about?
Okay, yeah. We fund the Toronto Hostel Training Centre, which is, you know, where the agency that you've just noted. And they provide, I think they're currently offering about 120 different workshops. They offer in the area of about 6 certificate courses mm-hmm. that people can, you know, take the required training, individual training courses to then get their certificate, and they hold a graduation every year for people who've gone through that process. We have a contract with the Toronto Hospital Training Centre that basically says that they will offer all of the training that is set out in the Toronto Shelter Standards. So if you look at it, at the standards in Section 9, it talks about what the mandatory training for shelter staff is, what the mandatory training for staff who work with children, what the mandatory training for food service staff, and then it also gives a whole bunch of recommended training. So the expectation is, you know, we, through developing the Toronto Shelter Standards, set out what the training is. The expectation is, you know, through our contract with the training center, that they are offering this set of training so that it is available for providers to send staff to. They have a process internally within their own structure where they approve courses and the I guess facilitators who are offering the training. Mm-hmm. We have on occasion gone and sat in and sort of audited the courses. Some of the courses we actually facilitate ourselves. The shelter standards is an example of that. We have one dedicated staff here who delivers the Toronto Shelter Standards training. The training center reports back to us on a monthly basis in terms of, you know, the courses, the volume of courses mm-hmm. over the course of the month or quarterly. It might be actually quarterly.
Yeah.
They report back to us in terms of what's been offered. And then our check of that, our check of it is when we go out and do quality assurance mm-hmm. and we say to providers, okay, show us your staff training records.
Yeah.
So we would go through for every staff in the agency to see mm-hmm. if you're working in food preparation, have you taken these 4 mandatory courses?
Oh, I see. So it's divided as to what exactly specifically your job is, depending on what training you need.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's overall training that you'll see. There's overlap between, like, everyone is expected to take the shelter standards training.
Okay.
And then, you know, if you're a frontline shelter staff, you know, it would be expected that you've got first aid, you've got crisis intervention, mm-hmm. you've got WMIS, you've got anti-racism, anti-oppression, and so there's those mandatory ones. If you were working with children, there might be different ones that are considered mandatory for working with kids. Say, for example, duty to report under the Child and Welfare Act, mm-hmm. right? The CFSA, Child and Family Services Act. Behavior management, that sort of stuff.
I'm interested in talking a bit more about the anti-oppression workshop.
Yeah.
Is that mandatory for everybody in the shelter to take that?
Yep. If you see in Section 9, mandatory training for shelter staff, anti-racism, okay. anti-oppression, and there's actually a timeline associated with it.
Okay.
It has to be within the first year of employment.
So do you know if that's monitored? Is that only monitored by the city, or is it actually monitored by the shelter as well?
The agencies, absolutely. They are I think what we saw when we went out and did QA1 was that, I have to say, it's a fair argument, that shelter providers struggle with staff training. I mean, there's a cost associated with it.
Yeah.
There's the cost of the training. There's the cost sometimes of paying the staff to be off. And when you're talking about a frontline position, oftentimes you have to backfill that person.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a cost associated with that. We've tried over the years to provide funding to assist people, particularly when this document came out,
mm-hmm.
To cover some of those costs. And the training center course costs are quite reasonable. But I think you have to, you need to be realistic in terms of, the budget that providers actually have to be able to send people on training.
Do shelters actually have their own training as well for anti-oppression training, or is it just the workshop put out by the city?
Many do, and they can actually go to the training center to sort of have the training vetted through the training center if they were going to offer any one of these pieces of training on site. The expectation is, I think the expectation is to send people to training at the training center. There's benefit in that because I like it because you get a mixed group of people at the table. It's not just everyone from your agency. You might have people who are from a youth shelter provider and a men's shelter provider and a women's shelter
mm-hmm.
and a family shelter provider. So I think there's interesting things that come out of that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, providers often, particularly maybe things like first aid and CPR, they will offer it on site and they are expected to keep staff training records, and they're the records that we actually use to evaluate whether they're meeting the standard or not, whether it is offered at the training center or if it's something that's similar that they've offered in-house. And one of the things that I know a number of providers have done in-house is around trans access training.
Mm-hmm.
So the 519 provides really phenomenal training on trans access, and our standards say that it doesn't state that it's mandatory that mm-hmm. it happens, but it does state that it's strongly recommended that all shelter staff have trans training.
Yeah.
And I know that there have been a number of providers who have contacted the 519 directly and had them come out and do the workshop in-house, because again, there's probably cost benefit to doing it that way as well, and that's completely acceptable to do it that way. So if we went out and were evaluating whether or not they had done the trans training, certainly it would be documented within their records that the 519 had come out.
Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I know you said, just to back up for one moment,
sure.
You said about the anti-oppression training workshop that it should be done within the first year of employment.
Right.
Is that training supposed to only be done once, or is it like an ongoing training that they receive every year, or is it just like the one time the first year?
At this point, I mean, we're not as implicit in this version of the standards
right.
to say that it should be ongoing or it should be refreshed or whatever the case may be. And it's things like first aid and CPR, you know that they have to be, right? Because there's another framework that's associated with that. I think it's a valid point that I think you're getting at is mm-hmm. that, certainly you could take it and you took it 10 years ago.
Right.
So what do you, you know, here we are 10 years later.
Yeah.
So it's a valid point, and I would say it's a valid point with any of these things, right, in terms of crisis prevention and de-escalation training,
mm-hmm.
That is there sort of a mandatory refresher period might potentially be something that we look at when we look at the next version of the standards. I would say as well that if particular issues come to our attention, that would be something that we would look at and we would consider. I would think that if there was a particular instance at a shelter
mm-hmm.
where perhaps we had seen a lot of complaints about anti-racism, anti-oppression, discrimination, that would be a discussion we would have with an individual shelter provider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would go in and ask, okay, so how often do you do anti-oppression training? Is it time for you to sit all your staff down and actually do a refresher course? So although it's not here and it's not in the standards, or it's not something I can say that we do expect on a system level, I think on an individual shelter provider, if things came to our attention, absolutely, it would be something we would be having a discussion with the provider about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. And what in your opinion are the top three reasons that you've become homeless?
For you specifically?
Yeah.
My experience, I've never worked in the youth system. I've worked in the family system. My frontline experience is actually working in the family shelter system. So, of course, I was dealing with kids who were still with their family,
mm-hmm.
but up to the age of 16, 17, 18. My experience is, I think family breakdown is probably one of the top reasons.
Yeah.
I think there's an aspect of that that's tied into abuse. For sure. So,
yeah.
You know, if I was to say my top two reasons for youth homelessness, I would say would be family breakdown and abuse. I would say that, you know, for maybe the reason people stay homeless is more around economic factors and the limited options, particularly, I think, challenging for youth around affordable housing. So, you know, maybe you become homeless because you've been kicked out of your home, and there's been issues with your parents, or abuse between, you know, children and their parents.
Mm.
You know, and the reason people perhaps stay homeless is because there aren't really good options around particularly supportive, affordable housing for people where their needs can still continue to be met.
Right. So as you know, my work focuses mainly on LGBTQ youth
yes.
homelessness.
Yeah.
And I like to look at sort of where the support services are available to them in Toronto.
Right.
So a lot of the LGBTQ youth who I have spoken to have discussed homophobia and transphobia that they've continuously encountered
mm-hmm.
in the shelter system and throughout the city. And the fact that they, you know, they feel safer sleeping on a park bench than they do in the shelter system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering how that makes you feel, and if you believe that's something that could be changed.
Yeah, you know, I'm saddened, actually, sincerely saddened to hear that. I don't think no one should ever feel that it's safer to sleep on a park bench than to sleep in a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it can be changed. And I think, you know, we talked about, I think there's some misinformation out there. You know, I have to say, my experience working with our youth shelter providers, I really believe that the majority of them are absolutely a really strong, committed group of people who believe in youth. You know, they in many ways dedicated their lives to working with youth.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's of all youth, you know, the people that I've met. But I think that, you know, to change that, and we touched on it a little bit, I think there's a big piece of education that
mm-hmm.
needs to be done. And I think that's education with providers
yeah.
around the things that we talked about, the anti-oppression, the discrimination, the issues specific to youth, to queer youth,
yeah.
absolutely. I mean, then I would say, on the other hand, there has to be education with some of the youth that, you know, you're referring to, who are feeling that a park bench is safer than a shelter. I think that there needs to be a connection with that group to sort of educate them about the services that are out there. Because I know that there are youth shelters out there that have a strong reputation in terms of being trans-friendly, mm-hmm. in terms of being queer-friendly. Absolutely. And they're known, and they're out there amongst the system. And I think it's important that people are aware that those programs and those services are out there. You know, we've had that sort of discussion in the past with providers around, trans has come up a number of times around trans issues, around, you know, whether you would have a shelter that's specifically dedicated for a client group. Mm-hmm. So whether it was, you know, an LGBTQ shelter,
right.
Or a trans friendly shelter. We've had these discussions with the community in the past.
Yeah.
We've sort of opted to go with more of the approach where we hold the whole system accountable, and that we expect them to be accessible to all, and that they're all, you know, all shelters are treating people with dignity and respect, and respecting gender identity and respecting sexual orientation, and holding people accountable to that rather than moving to a more specialized type of shelter setting. So I think it's kind of, it's about educating the youth as well, who, as I said, would prefer to stay out there, to let them know what services are out there, which services maybe would be a better fit, mm-hmm. for them and their particular sets of needs. We have our assessment and referral center that's run by the City of Toronto. If someone was to actually call them and explain their circumstance, there's a caseworker who picks up the phone and actually will make a referral for that individual. So if they're prepared to disclose, mm-hmm. that they're looking for somewhere that is more queer friendly, then that worker would work with them to get them into a shelter. Yeah. But, you know, that being said, I still don't want to not hold the whole system accountable, mm-hmm. and help providers who perhaps aren't as accessible come to a place where they are more accessible. And the other thing kind of ties back, you know, in relation to this question about how can it be changed, it ties back to our discussion about our complaints process. Mm-hmm. So if there are youth who are out there who feel that there aren't shelter beds for them because of homophobia or transphobia, they need to be calling us at the city. Because, mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the fact that we administer 57 shelter sites. There's about 4,000 shelter beds out there. It's a fairly extensive system. Mm-hmm. It's helpful if people come forward to us and express these things, because then it alerts the issue to us.
Yeah.
That's how it gets on our radar, through things like the complaints process, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So I can't stress that, you know, we take all those complaints really seriously, and that anyone who is experiencing discrimination needs to be calling us and making us aware of that.
Absolutely. I think it could be quite complicated, though, because homophobia and transphobia, it is so complex, and there are so many layers, and there's that whole, it's very traumatic, and I think that it could be very difficult for someone to call, especially if they're not aware of the phone number. And
absolutely.
But yeah, the piece around education, especially, I think, even maybe, you know, this homophobia that occurs in the shelter system from other youth who are attending services. So, you
right.
know, education probably needs to occur on many different levels.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other thing is, if there are youth out there, queer youth out there who aren't, who are homeless but not accessing the shelter system, mm-hmm. I think our Streets to Homes unit is a really good option for many people. So if, and, you know, and again, I'm not in any way excusing the system, saying, you know, if someone's perception is it's not queer or trans friendly, but that, you know, because of our Housing First strategy at the moment, that Streets to Homes would be certainly willing or able to work with youth who are homeless but not staying in shelter, mm-hmm. to help them access permanent housing,
right.
and then put support services in place with them and hook them up with
yeah.
all of the agencies to help them, you know, to get that support. So I think that's another good option, and that kind of goes back to, nobody should be sleeping on a park bench,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, in theory I know, but I think they need to be making us aware of it. And again, you know, we could hook people in with Streets to Homes if they're interested in housing, you know.
I think one of the main things that I came here today to talk about, and sort of what's been brought to my attention from the youth that I've spoken to, mm-hmm. is more on the sort of crisis level. So just say a queer youth has just come out and they've been kicked out of the house mm-hmm. for coming out, which happens quite often.
Okay.
And then they've experienced homophobia or transphobia on the streets, and then even in the shelter system. So that automatically kicks them out of the system. If they've gone to several different shelters and they've experienced it ongoing, so
right.
automatically it becomes safer for them to sleep elsewhere. That's from what I've heard.
Okay.
So in your opinion, like where would you suggest that these youth are supposed to sleep when they've experienced such abuse, like in that crisis situation? Because we don't have that sort of specialized emergency sort of shelter.
Yeah. I mean, that's a difficult...
Yes.
It's a very difficult question. And
yeah.
again, I mean, I think if somebody was feeling that way, I think that through our assessment and referral center, we could find an appropriate placement for an individual that was in such circumstance. And I'm not familiar enough with sort of the crisis support services that are out there, but they are out there.
Yeah.
But I think that in that instance, if you could get someone into a shelter that was perhaps better able to meet the needs of queer youth and then help them hook into the support services to get through that crisis, absolutely. If the person was a little more stabilized and was interested in, from there, then getting hooked up into housing, then that's ideal as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I think it's about holding the system accountable, that there are more options
mm-hmm.
for people. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that can be done overnight, not when you've got 57 shelters and 4,000 shelter beds.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that we are committed to doing because, you know, everybody needs to have housing options, right, from homeless shelters to permanent housing.
Absolutely.
And they shouldn't be... certainly should not be sleeping on park benches.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, I think if somebody was in crisis, they can call our office. You know, I mean, we do a lot of that kind of work as well, where calls come in to us and people, don't know the phone numbers, because you're right, you know, those numbers aren't necessarily out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people can call Streets to Homes or the Assessment and Referral Center and can call us and, you know, we will help to get them somewhere safe, because that's always one of our first calls. When someone calls in with a complaint, or sorry, not our first calls, our first messages back to people when a call comes into our office is, you know, are you safe? Do you have a place to stay tonight?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways it's about the education of youth as well to connect with us. And I know there's trust issues sort of associated with that,
mm-hmm.
that may not make it easy, and particularly if in the circumstance that you've just described where you've been kicked out of your house and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. I know you spoke about this a bit earlier when we started to discuss this issue, just about that about gearing away from specialized services
mm-hmm.
and sort of making the whole system like a safer place.
Yeah.
Is there any interest in implementing any specialized services for queer youth?
Interesting, we've had discussions with some community agencies around that. I don't know if we would ever move to a place where there was a standalone shelter,
mm-hmm.
but I think you could very possibly look at having specialized services within a particular program. So say, for example, if there was a shelter provider that was interested in doing, you know, a number of beds within their program that were specific for queer youth, I think that would very definitely be something that we'd be interested in sort of exploring further. I mean, we're just not in new shelter development mode, quite frankly, because we've moved to a housing first place. In fact, over the last number of years, we've probably closed more shelter beds than we've actually opened.
Mm-hmm.
Because the emphasis is on moving people into housing. So it would be difficult for me to kind of imagine at this point opening a new standalone shelter. But I think the way to go, and I referred to it before, is making sure that the services that are being offered are meeting the needs of the clients in the community or within the shelter. So if that meant opening up a specific number of beds mm-hmm. within a particular shelter that was dedicated to that, that would very definitely be something we'd be interested in talking to people about. And, you know, an example of that is there's a number of providers that within their program operate abstinence-based beds. So, you know, the shelter might be 100 beds, and 25 of those beds, one floor of the shelter, is specifically dedicated for clients who are, you know, wanting to live in an abstinence-based sort of environment. They're sort of going through a recovery process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We have other shelters at the other end of the spectrum that have beds that are specifically harm reduction. Mm-hmm. Beds and dedicated to clients who are, you know, struggling with substance use issues. So it's that kind of a model that I think is would be more where our thinking would be. You may, you know, open up, you know, for vulnerable youth, mm-hmm. a particular part of a program or something. You know, because mm-hmm. there's also, you know, to be quite frank, there's also sort of a stigmatism that goes with or a marginalization. And you and I have talked about that before, sort of about, you know, by how do you balance that with making sure that you're, you know, you're meeting the needs of someone and they're getting the support services that they need mm-hmm. and not wanting to further marginalize anybody. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation that it's like an ongoing conversation that totally. People tend to have about sort of segregated services.
Totally.
But I think it's, you know, it's really difficult, especially when people's safety are at risk. When safety is number one, of
totally,
course.
Totally, absolutely.
You know, it makes me think about women's shelters and how do you think that, having women's shelters, is that further marginalized women?
No, and fair enough, And, you know, I don't, the 519 had done, it, and it, this was related to trans access.
Right.
But we had been part of their project around the FDM safe shelter.
Exactly, yeah.
Right, and it incredible process,
yeah.
You know, and the report is actually quite phenomenal.
It really is.
The city is very supportive of the recommendations that have come out of that, and I think there is a whole host of recommendations around expectations around safety and discrimination and all of those sorts of things that absolutely that agenda, you know, should be pushed forward for sure, because it is, you're right, I can't argue that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much for taking your time today to speak with
you. My pleasure.